have three appearances, I believe. So could you please make your appearances? All right, very good, thank you. Mr. Bruce, I believe you have 25 minutes, followed by Mr. Cincotta, 20 minutes, followed by Mr. Friedman, 10 minutes, followed again by Mr. Bruce for rebuttal, 5 minutes, correct?
Yes, sir.
All right, very good. Please proceed. And just so you all know, Justice Ann Welsh Bradley is appearing by phone.
Thank you. Please let me know if you can't hear me. As I indicated, my name is John Bruce. I appear on behalf of the City of Waukesha. This is a public records case. It was commenced on December 18, 2017. The records at issue, or which are at issue for purposes of argument, were disclosed on December 20, 2017. Other records were disclosed prior to that date by the city. I think the records will show that Friends, I think they said they somewhat quickly commenced the action because the Common Council of the City of Waukesha was meeting on December 19th, 27 to address the records specifically that question, which I have called in the briefs draft contracts. So they commenced the action apparently in order to commence it prior to the holding of the Common Council meeting.
Council, I find most interesting the responsive letter about why this park use contract was not provided. That there were, quote, at least one other entity that was competing for a baseball team. What was meant by what is the other entity? Was it another municipality? What was it? What is the other entity? I couldn't find anything about that in the record.
I am not sure what the other entity was. I don't think it was another municipality.
Why do you think that?
Simply because I think it would have been communicated to me if there was. But I really have no idea what the other entity
is. That question was presented to the circuit court, and I read the transcripts from the circuit court. That certainly was something that the circuit court thought Waukesha was thinking about. I mean, it's critical, at least I believe it's critical. We'll see what the court says. I believe it's critical that the reason given was a reason that Waukesha could lawfully withhold the record that was requested. And that was a reason that was given. So I guess that's why this concerns me.
I see. I don't think that it was required that an entity different from the entity with which the city was bargaining directly, Big Top Baseball,
it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit in the language of what's said. And at least one other entity that may be competing with the city of Waukesha for a baseball team. That's what the letter says. Now, you can't put in if another entity is competing with the city of Waukesha for a baseball team, how can you say that's Big Top? That's who they're dealing with. It's not some other entity. That's the person that Waukesha said they were bargaining with, correct?
Yes, and that exception applies for bargaining reasons as well as competitive reasons.
Why in the letter...
No sense to me.
Didn't you say something to the equivalent in the letter that the city had explained council had not reviewed the draft contracts? Big Top and the city We're still negotiating, and other entities may consider attracting Big Top's business away from the city. Isn't that essentially what the letter said?
Well, the letter certainly speaks for itself, but I guess I'm having trouble understanding why it is essential to the issue as to whether that exception applied, that there be another entity involved in bargaining with the city.
I don't know if it's essential or not, but one of the reasons you gave was that other entities, I'm looking for the exact language, but basically that other entities may consider attracting Big Top's business away from the city.
Right.
So that to me implies that it's other than those currently negotiating, right?
It also says may, which would indicate that there were not currently at that time anyone competing, but the concern would have been that there may be competitors in the future.
Okay, so you're saying releasing it would have affected whether or not someone else might swoop in and take the Big Top away?
I believe that was a concern. Again, I didn't write the letter. I'm not the city attorney for Waukesha. That's Brian Running. But
I'm just
that would
trying
be
to
my interpretation.
Figure out your answer to Justice Rogensack, because at first I thought you were saying there aren't any others and we kind of didn't mean that. Now I'm hearing you say there may or may not have been others, but it's still a valid concern when you're in the stages we were
in. Yeah, I don't think that I said there actually are or were others. I think I said I didn't know whether there were others or not. But I think the operative word there, the significant word there, is the word may. No actual representation is made that there is another entity.
So how do you reconcile your word may, which I assume it always may be the case that someone else can swoop in, with the language of the exemption, which says that whenever competitive or bargaining reasons require a closed session? How do you reconcile may with require?
Well, I reconcile. Reconciliation isn't required because it's clear that, undisputed, I think, that the city was bargaining with Big Top Baseball.
Okay, so in your, so anytime you're bargaining with anybody else, you don't have to turn over records? That can't be what that means, right? What do we do with the word require, which has been defined to be pretty specific in our case law leading up to this case as not being what you might like or what might be something that they prefer, but it has to actually be something that's required, right?
And I was hoping to address that in my argument. But again, I think it's important to understand that the exception doesn't apply merely for competitive reasons. Bargaining would involve negotiation of a contract. One isn't competing with another entity when you're negotiating a contract with them, you're bargaining with them. The bargaining here was going on between Big Top Baseball and the city of Waukesha. And the position of the city would be that under the circumstances, this case, bargaining required non-disclosure of the draft or proposed contract at issue.
But why?
I'm happy to address that. There are, I think, two important issues at hand here. One has to do with whether the Court of Appeals changed the governing test with respect to eligibility for attorney's fees. One has to do with the propriety of the city's evocation of the exception to the open meetings law requirements. I think it's essential in understanding the city's position with respect to the applicability of that exemption, to understand the power and authority of the Common Council in city government. The Court of Appeals took the position in its decision that there was no negotiation taking place with respect to the proposed contract. I think that in doing so, they did not understand the fact that the Common Council is, in effect, the city for purposes of bargaining contracts. It is the entity that has authority to make decisions with respect to whether a city enters into a contract, the same as any other governing body of a municipality. So when the Court of Appeals says the contract was negotiated already, I think they're fundamentally incorrect under the law. That's the Town of Brockway case I referred to, and I think anyone who's represented a municipality is well aware of the fact that common councils frequently and sometimes drastically and dramatically disagree with department heads and staff, particularly when it comes to contracts to be entered into by the city.
But why does that matter?
It matters. Well,
if the common council approved it, why does it matter? I mean, so they approve it, so they don't approve it. How does that affect the exception, which only allows for withholding of this document if bargaining required withholding of the document? Well, I mean, whether they approve it or not, how does that affect?
Well, I think negotiation, particularly with a municipal corporation, is a process. Negotiation was continuing at the time the Common Council would be addressing it. Now, the law very clearly states that the decision maker is the Common Council. If a draft contract is disclosed prior to its review by a Common Council, I think that the authority of the Common Council to make a decision in a system of representative government where they make that decision, not the public, not the media, may be impacted negatively by disclosure of the contract to the public prior to review by the Common Council as decision.
Well, Council, that's exactly what they did here. The minutes of the meeting show no action taken on this contract at all, and yet they disclosed it. I mean, that's exactly what they did. They never decided if it was what they wanted to do or what they didn't want to do or that more bargaining was needed. There's absolutely nothing in the minutes about this contract being reviewed by the Common Council.
There's nothing indicating that it was adopted by the Common Council or that it gave direction with respect to it. There is no need for a Common Council under the law or Robert's Rules of Order to say we elect not to adopt.
No, I'm talking about your argument, and your argument responding to Justice Dallet was that you needed this to be confidential prior to review by the Common Council. And my rejoinder to you is they provided it prior to Common Council review, that they did it the day after the Council met, but there's nothing in the minutes of the Council that the Council ever took it up and talked about it.
And all I can say, Your Honor, is that the law does not require that the minutes reflect
as I'm reading 1985 sub 1 sub E, and if we take it to the phrase beyond what Justice Dallet was talking about, it says, whenever competitive or bargaining reasons, and these are the four words I want to ask you about, require a closed session. I can't find anything in the record that talks about the Common Council being in closed session. So if I understand your argument, it is, look, we didn't have to turn these over because there was a competitive or bargaining reason, and that's fine, but that reason needs to require then a closed session. Is there something that I'm missing in the record that indicates that there was a closed session of the Common Council?
I don't know of anything in the record.
So help me then understand your argument as it relates to that statute, in particular that phrase. What is it that required a closed session if a closed session never in fact occurred?
There is no obligation to enter on the part of anybody. They may elect not to. The fact that they elected not to does not mean that the exception is applicable. They just decided not to take advantage of it.
So if I understand your argument, it is, look, there was a competitive or bargaining reason. It required a closed session. But we didn't decide to have the city council decided not to have a closed session.
Yes, I think that is within the discretion of anybody under the open meetings laws not to go into closed session. The law requires that a roll call vote be taken in order to enter into closed session. They apparently did not elect to go into closed session. I don't think that takes away from the viability or the applicability of the exception that they exercise the discretion not to go into closed session.
Oh, and following along that line, why did it require a closed session, even if they didn't choose to go into one?
I think it is required because, given the nature of the Common Council and its involvement in the process, effective negotiation, effective bargaining by the Common Council as representatives of the people should be making the decision regarding whether or not the city should enter into the into a contract or take any other action where no statutory public hearing is required. It is essential to their achievement and performance of their duties that they do so without being influenced by positions taken by the public or the media, which could affect their impartial accomplishment and performance of their duties as the decision.
So pretty much any time a Common Council has to approve something, they don't have to turn anything over until after they've gone through that process.
There are laws which specifically state that what's called a public hearing is required. Zoning changes, which come before a governing body, budgets, special assessments, things of that nature. The law provides that notice has to be given of what is going to be addressed by the Common Council and an opportunity given for the public to participate in those meetings as to those specific statutory items, which they do not otherwise have in circumstance. Hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Council, ultimately, your decision at the end of the day was based on the public policy balancing test, I think, correct? In the
yes.
letter, I mean, you point to some of these issues, but at the end of the day, that's sort of the fundamental basis, and you point to these as public policy rationales that underlie your balancing test determination, but that's what you relied on to deny it, correct?
Yes, I think that's true, Your Honor. It's a case where there was no specific statute saying records should not be disclosed.
Right.
It was a case of the application of the balancing test, and the balancing test under the law allows the legal custodian of the records to take into account circumstances of the matter, the context of the request. And I think that's essentially what the city attorney was doing here. And I think the role of the Common Council in exercising its authority without influence, I know I'll probably be criticized by saying this is contrary to democracy and freedom, but it's the nature of the law that decision is purely that of the Common Council. I think the Circuit Court recognized that in its decision and actually spoke to that in explaining why he felt there was a reasonable basis for use of or evocation of this particular exception to the open meetings law, excuse me. Trying to find it here. It's on page 14 of the transcript of the court's decision, Circuit Court's decision, which I think is identified as
yes, we
have. Petitioner's App 145, and I'm quoting from it.
Could we transition to the second part, the attorney's fees part? And I just want to throw out a question and like your opposing counsel to address it as well. One of the things that I find a little curious about the Court of Appeals decisions in this case, and this court's never had an opportunity to address this, But we've got a statute here, a statute that talks about requester prevailing in whole or in substantial part. And the concept of a prevailing party statute has a particular kind of meaning in the law. The Supreme Court has addressed this, too, and rejected the idea that a catalyst theory or a causation analysis is the proper way to analyze a prevailing party statute. That prevailing party is a particular kind of meaning. It means somebody who won or had some admission of liability. And I'm wondering how we're supposed to make sense of several cases that the Court of Appeals have outlined here, and obviously we've got an example of that here with the Court of Appeals below. How are we supposed to reconcile that with this statutory language, which doesn't ask about catalyst or causation, and asks about prevailing party?
In all frankness, Justice Hagedorn, I'm not sure. I think I indicated my briefs, and I will certainly frankly admit now I find the Court of Appeals decision confusing. I'm not entirely sure what it intends by its holding. I think the case law is clear with respect to the need to establish a causal nexus, not just in Wisconsin public records law, but Federal Freedom of Information Act, which was referred to by the Court of Appeals initially. But you also see that in other fee-shifting statutes, such as the Civil Rights Act, where even where there's voluntary compliance with the law, the requirement is that a causal link between a lawsuit and the relief obtained be established. That's the case of Hartman versus Winnebago County. It's a Court of Appeals case which was reversed on other grounds by the Supreme Court. And also under the Consumer Act, Community Credit Plan versus Johnson, and I'd be happy to provide the citations. But those were both cases in which the defendant voluntarily complied eventually with the requirements of the law without a court order. But in those cases, the catalyst test was applied. There had to be a causal link between the lawsuit and the relief, not really relief, voluntary compliance.
Counsel, as a follow-up, I see your light, your yellow light is on, so I want to get to my question before it expires. I think the principal issue, what this litigation is all about, is the recovery of attorney fees. So for me, that is the principal issue and perhaps the dispositive issue. And frankly, when I look at the Court of Appeals case law, I can't make heads or tails of it either. There's two different lines. None of them take a textual approach to applying the meaning of what it means to prevail in whole or substantial part. Now, I did look at the history of our statute. It appears to be modeled after, although it does not repeat verbatim language from federal FOIA Act. But we are, you know, I think our analysis can be informed by federal law in that regard. And as Justice Hagedorn pointed out, it was the, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right, Buchanan case, 522 U.S. 598, back in 2001, that rejected the catalyst theory and did apply the plain and original meaning of what it means to be a prevailing party. And to summarize in the interest of time, that means that judicial relief was obtained. That's the only way one can be a prevailing party. So isn't your argument, your best argument, a textual one rather than an application of Court of Appeals cases that went far afield of what the statute actually provides with respect to recovery of attorney fees?
I don't think, and again, admittedly, this is a Court of Appeals decisions, and federal decisions and decisions in other fee-shifting situations. I think the concern of the law was to provide for compensation of a litigant where what they did actually caused some sort of action by, in this case, the custodian of records. I think that would be the basis on which fees should be recovered, because then at least there's a causal relationship between the actual incurring of attorney's fees.
That would require a factual hearing, right? Because we don't really know, and the trial court would have to make a decision, I think, as to what caused the release of records, because otherwise, any time the holder of records released a record after a lawsuit was filed, under this Court of Appeals opinion, attorney fees are automatic, right?
Under this
and
Court of Appeals.
I don't think that's right under the statute.
Right. I don't think it is either. I think we also have to take into consideration the fact that it's the litigant, the plaintiff in these actions, that has the burden of proof to show that attorney's fees should be awarded. That seems to be pretty clear under the case of State X Rel Vaughn versus Faust. A party seeking attorney's fees under Section 19.372 must show that prosecution of the action could reasonably be regarded as necessary to obtain the information, and that a causal nexus exists between the action and the agency's surrender of the information.
Counsel, you indicate point to the causation language, and yet on page 14 of the non-party brief of the news media, they indicate that there are circumstances in which that causation test is unnecessary and runs afoul of policy. Continuing on that page, they say, in essence, at least here, there was a substantial prevailing. Number one, the requester has received the requested records. And number two, the requester has put an end to an unnecessary and unlawful delay in producing the record. Can you respond to that? If there's not time now, I'd like you to respond when you get up to offer rebuttal, a response, rather, to the argument on page 14 that there has been a substantial showing here of prevailing for those two reasons.
Okay, should I wait for rebuttal to do that then?
Please answer Justice Bradley's question.
Thank you. Just reviewing page 14. I guess this doesn't make any sense to me. Well, again, I do have to keep referring to Court of Appeals precedent here, because I think that goes to whether the appeals had authority to make the decision it makes in this case. But I just don't see how this follows when a governmental body voluntarily releases records. Following the filing of a mandamus action, the record requester has prevailed. Again, the law is clear that, and again I'm referring to Court of Appeals precedent, that the mere fact that action has been commenced and disclosure made after commencement of the litigation does not mean that the plaintiff is entitled to attorney's fees. This is not a post hoc ergo propter hoc situation. So if I understand what the amicus is saying here on page 14, it flies in the face of that body of law created by the Court of Appeals, and I just don't see how it can be inferred that voluntary release necessarily results where there has been wrongful evocation of an exception to the public records law merely by virtue of the fact that an action was commenced, and that it necessarily follows that the action was a cause, at least a cause, of the release.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Counsel?
(Clears throat) May it please the court, my name is Joe Sincott. I'm again representing the respondent here, Friends of Frame Park. First, on the issue that the court addressed early on in the previous argument, I'd like to just hit on some of the points. The balancing test idea is in the case law, but I think in this case it's confined to the application of the open meetings exception that the city attorney invoked. And I think the core task here for the court and what the Court of Appeals did was to see if that exception applied. I think there's two issues, whether it applied in the facts in this case, whether, as the Supreme Court has discretion, it applies in a way that will guide the state, and the court wants to address that exception in a broader sense. I don't think it applied in the facts of this case. But let me step aside or back and say there are two justifications provided in that exception. You can compete or you can be bargaining. I do think they're meant to be two separate things. The Court of Appeals addressed it as such, and the language is it that way. And the city attorney, I think, meant to address it as such, but the letter of October 23rd, the response letter, does conflate them to an extent. Let's separate them. They're not competing with anyone at the time. This is clear. Could they be? I don't think that counts.
Why is it clear?
That they're not competing?
Yeah, that they're not competing with some other entity in the neighborhood for a baseball team. When I say the neighborhood, I mean the geographic area from which fans would be drawn.
I don't have the pinpoint site, but City Administrator Lehner in his deposition said that this involves the Northwoods League, right? So there's the league
I understand.
Above Big Top.
I'm talking about another city aside from an entity. Why isn't it possible that another city, would be competing for the baseball team?
The franchise. Yeah, I think that based on what he said, the Northwoods League had decided they like Big Top and the city of Waukesha. It's like some of the draft documents deal with the Northwoods League involvement with them.
Well,
so that was my understanding of what his testimony was.
Okay. Well, that certainly is not consistent with other parts of the record, but that's fine.
And I guess the other answer is it could be that other cities had in mind to compete, but I don't know that that's in the record or shown. I think the city needs to have they need to have a basis to speculate that someone's competing. I don't know. I don't think they had that. So I don't think they're competing with anyone at the time, because the Northwoods had made the decision. Big Top was going to be in Waukesha. So I don't think that applies.
Where do you find in the record a decision has been made that Northwoods chose Waukesha through the auspices of Big Top, who was the kind of umbrella entity for many baseball teams, including Madison's baseball team? So where do you find that in the record?
I think I have an extra of that from the deposition. I'm going to try to track it down here.
Okay, well, I don't want to take all your time on that.
Yeah.
So if it doesn't bother my colleagues, if you think it's in the record in a deposition, I'll get my law clerk to read the deposition.
I think it is.
Okay.
But I guess it would raise the question, and the court certainly can this. Well, maybe that wasn't dispositive. Maybe there was another city that was still inquiring with Northwoods, bring the franchise to our city. I don't know if that guessing that might be going on is sufficient in this context to withhold records. A big reason for that is the other justification, which is the bargaining justification. And here, I think the Court of Appeals is correct. There's no need to withhold records that have been turned over to the other contracting party, the red line documents. The city has exchanged these red line documents with Big Top, a private. They're bargaining with Big Top But it's publicly known to the extent that Big Top knows what the city's views are. So the idea that you would keep the city administrator at that point and the city attorney's perspective on the terms of these draft contracts from the public, but give them to Big Top, does seem to be very counter to the idea of the records law. If there is discussion internally at the city and memoranda that address whether the city should agree to Big Top's proposed terms, that I could see being protected. That addresses the circuit court's idea of negotiating in public. But if you're going to share the documents with the arm's length party, the public, I think, gets to see them under a reasonable interpretation of the policy of the open meetings law. In particular, when the exception, the withholding, only allows you to do so if it's required. What is required? What could be required? What harm could come? This goes to a point that counsel made, which I was having a hard time determining exactly what he meant, but the idea that we brought in the idea that the common counsel is the ultimate decision maker. So that means, as I tried to say in my brief, nothing that happens before that then is negotiation and can be protected. What's protected is the common counsel's negotiations. They haven't occurred. So it doesn't help to me to say, well, the city council hasn't seen the documents, but even if they had, there's no negotiation that's occurred, i.e. no bargaining. And so from that, we withhold all the records that have come before that. That doesn't seem to follow from what I can tell.
Thanks, counsel. If I could just move to the second question in the case. Justice Rebecca Bradley and I both asked about this line of Court of Appeals cases, and again, we've not addressed these questions, and how that comports with the statutory. And I just wanted to give you an opportunity to address that, because when we're thinking about this and what the proper test is, and you've got the way to analyze this, the statute says, uses this prevailing party type language. It's common in other statutes, common in contracts, those sorts of things. There's an established body of law around that. How that comports with the catalyst or causation type of theories that have been developed and expounded upon in the courts below?
Well, my response to you, Justice, is to lean on that plain language mostly, because I don't, having had some exposure to this theory and a little bit in some other fee-shifting context, I don't understand it fully myself and how it's supposed to apply. I think generally the courts feel there needs to be a check in the system so that it's not automatic that prevailing parties, maybe that's a term of art, but a party that succeeds gets their attorney's fees. I'm not sure why. Coming from the side of the party, the lawyer who does a lot of this type of work, it's not easy. And people aren't running around filing cases because they want attorney's fees. We didn't do that in this case. We did that because we continued the case because we wanted the issue, the substantive issue, to be heard by the courts. But the plain language prevails in whole and in part. I don't see anything in there that gives me, oh, that means I have to show that what I did caused them to release the records, even though the fact that they withheld them initially was shown to be wrong. So I don't see where it's in there. Now, the Court of Appeals, I think, in an effort to try to reconcile some of this stuff, at page 19 of their opinion, talks about the Church of Scientology case, and that's a federal case, 700 Fed Second, at 491. The Court of Appeals, our Court of Appeals, talking about that court, said, referring to the church, if the church was entitled to a substantial number of the pages of documents that were subsequently released, regardless of the Postal Service's eventual decision that the documents were not required for its investigation due to the passage of time, the church must be considered as having prevailed. I think the Court of Appeals, Wisconsin Court of Appeals, was trying to show that sometimes these cases are fuzzy, it's not so clear. We prevailed here, and that must mean that there is a presumption that you get attorney's fees.
Counsel, but that is a Court of Appeals decision that is making up a new test, which is different from past Court of Appeals decisions. And that greatly concerns me, because if there's to be a new test, we make it up. One Court of Appeals cannot do, in my view, what this Court of Appeals did, which was to adopt a new test and kind of read causation out of the previous cases, which relied heavily on causation.
Okay, I appreciate that, Your Honor. My sense was the Court of Appeals in District 2 was trying to harmonize what it could from our own law and from the federal law.
Well, it's overruling causation. Okay. And what it's doing is it's using the federal test. The only part of the federal test that I believe we have used is the words substantially prevail. So it's a sort of a quantitative thing, and we've used that in other cases too. But they read causation right out of all of the cases that precede it. When I read the case, I don't think we give the Court of Appeals that kind of authority. So what about that?
Yeah, I didn't see it as them breaching their authority, but I appreciate Your Honor's concern.
You think causation is still required under the Court of Appeals decision?
In a different context, it may be. If the city's withholding was in violation of the statute, then they should have released the records at the outset.
Okay, you're using a federal test when you say that to me. And the federal test is that if you use the wrong legal foundation to not provide the records, causation made you make a wrong decision. So the causation is attached to choosing the wrong basis to make the decision. In the case law in Wisconsin, causation is attached to the provision of the records due to filing a lawsuit. So the causation is attached to a different factor. And the laws are very different. Under the federal law, you're eligible for attorney's fees if, in fact, you breach the federal test. Under Wisconsin law, by statute, we are required to provide attorney's fees if causation is shown. So they're hooked together very differently, which I think is difficult for attorneys who practice there. But I think the federal court, that's fine. That's what works in the federal jurisprudence. But I think our Court of Appeals in this case applied a federal test, and when they did it, they read our past connection of causation attached to the lawsuit causing the record to be produced. They read it right out of the book. So how can I get around that?
Well, I appreciate that, and I think my amicus is going to have a lot of wisdom on this as well. But let me say, I think you go back to the language of the statute and the purpose of the law, and you apply it. And perhaps the court renders a decision that clarifies what the test in Wisconsin is. And let me tell you this about causation from a practical standpoint. Boy, is that challenging. You're the attorney. You've come in. You're in front of a judge in a county, and you're pursuing a city of that county, and you want to win a case about open records. And maybe you squeak by, and you win. But then there's a letter put out that says, well, we gave the records to them. We were going to do it anyway. So no causation. And the circuit judge says, you know what, I believe that. And so no causation.
Well,
it's a challenging test.
Causation is a fact question. Do you agree?
It is a fact question.
Okay.
I think the case law, the WTMJ case, says that you can make a determination based on the documentary evidence and such. But it does seem that prevailing should be a significant factor in that causation analysis. I can't see how you can separate causation from the statutory language. That would be my only way to answer that. And I do hope the court does reconcile what you have to do to prevail and then get attorney's fees. And if causation is required, are plaintiffs, are people that are seeking records to, you know, could it be a very political matter? Could it be like this? They're trying to be concerned about land use. Do they have to then be able to show that the city attorney or the city administrator or city officials are dissembling, that they're making stuff up, that they really aren't giving the records now because they're done holding them back, but it's actually because of a lawsuit?
I think you go before the circuit court, which is what happened here, and the city attorney said the reason we withheld them has expired. There's no longer a reason to withhold them, and that's why we gave them. And the circuit court makes a factual finding about whether that's a fact or whether it's not a fact. That's what happened here.
It is. I'm just saying practically it's quite a challenge. I did, in the record, as noted, I don't have the citation, but it's in the appendix. There's an email that I put out to city attorney right after he released the records to me, asking him what facts had changed. What is it that had changed that caused the release? And I didn't get a response. Later in court, the argument was made, well, we released him because the exception no longer applied in our view. So I think that's a difficult fact. I don't want to have to argue in front of judges and others, look, the city is shading things here. They're stretching stuff because they don't want to pay attorney's fees. They don't want to encourage guys like Santana.
You have the burden of proof to show causation.
Pardon?
You have the burden of proof to show causation if you want attorney's fees.
Under the case law. That's what it says. I understand that. I just think it runs contrary a little bit to the policy of the statute and the statutory language on prevailing.
Well, I'd like to return to the statutory language because when the United States Supreme Court 20 years ago rejected the catalyst theory or test, it did so in part because of all the subjectivity that is introduced into this analysis and how complicated it gets and the need for factual hearings. And this is all what happens when with all due respect to all my judicial colleagues everywhere, when judges try to supplant the law with their own made-up judicial tests instead of just applying the statutory language, which I find really straightforward because in one sense you did prevail. You were after a record. You got the record, right? But did you prevail in the action? The language of the statute gives you attorney's fees if you, the requester, prevails in whole or in substantial part in any action filed. You didn't prevail in the action filed, right? You got the record irrespective of the action. They voluntarily provided it to you, did they not?
Well, the records were provided after we filed the action. But I guess we look at us as prevailing under the Court of Appeals decision. The Court of Appeals said that we were correct, that our complaint, which was you cannot withhold the records based on what you're saying, that was true. That was correct under the law. So I thought we prevailed under the Court of Appeals decision in that respect.
Counsel, can you address, in relation to the questioning by Justice Rebecca Bradley, how the timing comes into this? I mean, this isn't a situation where it's about getting the records anytime, is it? Because then I could see an argument that, well, yeah, you got the records and you wanted the records and so you got them. How does the timeliness and the need to turn over records immediately pursuant to the statute and pursuant to the law, how does that play into your analysis?
I think it's another basis if there's an unreasonable delay. If you withhold them wrongly, that's one thing. If there's no time factor at issue, then it's not a time factor. Here there was, which is why I filed a quick complaint ahead of the Common Council meeting. Once we saw the agenda and the issue was up, you know, I've been around, and sometimes you'll get an argument, well, you didn't do your job. You didn't try to get those records before the meeting. So even if you were prejudiced because you didn't have them, you couldn't be prejudiced because you didn't try. So that's why I filed the case ahead of that Common Council meeting to lay down that record that says we want these records for the purpose of the open records law, to use them at the Common Council meeting. Don't keep the records from us and then agenda a meeting that's going to discuss the issue that those records are very pertinent to. So that's the key for us and for the citizens, and that's what is at their in their hearts. They're not sure about all this attorney's fee stuff, but they want the records right away so they can contribute to the Common Council. And that does not necessarily mean get up and ask questions or get answers. It rarely happens. It means knowledgeably participating and observing what happens at the Common Council. That seems to be very consistent with the open records law. Get the information to the public so that they can participate in real time on an issue and not maybe get it later only, and then say, well, I'll wait till the next spring election, and then I'll exercise my feelings about that. That's often invoked as a vehicle to provide a remedy to citizens, go to the ballot box. It just isn't sufficient. The records should be provided timely, And here, they needed to be provided ahead of this meeting. I will say they didn't do anything at the meeting about the issue, I think because I filed the case, and they didn't want it public at that time. But it didn't end. It didn't stop. The project was still ongoing. So we wanted to get the records, and we wanted to use them in subsequent public debate. My light just went off, my yellow light. I think I see the red, so I think I'm done. Thank you very much. I hope I addressed your questions.
Mm-hmm. All right, Mr. Friedman.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the Court, I'm James Friedman from Godfrey & Kahn Law Firm. I'm here to represent the Amicus Curiae, the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association, the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council, the Wisconsin Newspaper Association, the Wisconsin Transparency Project, and the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. And on behalf of all of my clients, I do want to thank the Court for letting us participate in this appeal and in this argument. Based on the discussions right before my argument, I'm going to make a little bit of a change. And I do believe the merits of the denial of the public records request is critical, and I do believe this case presents the Court an opportunity to make a pronouncement, hopefully in favor of transparency on a very significant issue under the open records law, one that I probably see more than almost anything else from my media clients. That said, I will start with the fees because it seems as if the Court may have a particular interest in the fee-shifting issue. I'd first like to respond to Justice Bradley, and with all due respect, Justice Bradley, I do disagree that in order to prevail in a lawsuit, you have to wait until the end and get a court pronouncement. I think in a situation where you are looking for one and only one thing in a lawsuit, in this case, the release of records, you file the lawsuit, and whether it's through a mediation, whether it's through negotiations, whether it's through motion practice or a trial, you receive the one thing that you sought in that lawsuit. I believe you have prevailed as our legislature intended. And I think to hold otherwise would provide some poor incentives both to the requesters and maybe more importantly to custodians of records.
Well, setting aside the consequences, counsel, my question is based on the long established, going back to the 19th century, understanding of what it means to be a prevailing party. And judicially, the cases all support, and I'd like to hear what cases besides our Court of Appeals precedent, which I don't even think addresses it, what precedent you have that supports a contrary interpretation historically of what it means to be a prevailing party, because that always meant prevailing in a court, receiving a judicial decree of some sort.
I'll be honest with you. I didn't come up here to list off cases. I will make two comments in that regard. I'd say one, as you noted, our Court of Appeals has never said you have to get to a final judgment in order to prevail under Section 19.37. I'll also note that before the Supreme Court pronouncement, which was in the middle of my time practicing, I am that old, in fact, the majority of federal courts found, and there was discretion there, but found that parties who had filed a lawsuit after being denied under FOIA had, and then the records were released before a final judgment, had in fact prevailed. So the earlier FOIA case law says that as well. I had FOIA cases where that was the law, and I understand the Supreme Court changed that, but there are, cases around the country that have found over the course of, many years that prevail does not have to be a final judgment. So needless to say, from my client's perspective, we believe that if a records request is denied, if you take advantage of the one and only one statutory recourse, which is to file a mandamus action, and if after that the records are released, we believe you have prevailed in all circumstances. Now that said, I don't think the court has to come to that conclusion today. I think today's case is easier than that. In this case, the Court of Appeals has held, and I believe this Court will as well, I hope this Court will as well, that the custodian wrongfully denied the request. The custodian was wrong. At that point, the requester took advantage of that sole recourse. They didn't file the next day. It was several weeks later. They filed a mandamus action, And then after the mandamus action, the custodian came to the conclusion that it should release the records. In that circumstance, where the custodian gets it wrong, where the requester does the only thing he, she, or they can do, which is file a mandamus action, and then they receive the records, it seems to me our legislature intended that in that case, the requesters were prevailing parties. And I think that is the answer the court should come up with today. The broader decision is not necessary. Now, if the court were to go to the next level and look at what the Court of Appeals has historically done, which is a causal nexus test, we don't think that's what prevail necessarily means. But if the court were to look at the causal nexus test, I do think it would be very helpful for the court to set forth how that works. Because otherwise, I think there is a lot of speculation, and it's a very difficult fact-finding process for a trial court.
Counsel, let me ask you a question, if I could. Imagine a scenario where, a political actor is sued for not turning over documents 2 days after the request. And let's say it's a complicated request, right? And you have this general guideline of 10 days for a simple request. But it's quick. And, nobody likes getting sued over public records issues. And so they turn them over the day after because they just want it to go away, not because they did anything wrong in those contexts. Your argument, as I understand it, would be that person is a prevailing party, even if the custodian in this situation, a political actor, would say, listen, I just don't want the political pain, and I'm not trying to hide anything, but people wanted their documents sooner than we could reasonably get to it. I just want to get it over with. What is your response to that?
I make a couple points in response to that, Justice Hagedorn. First, this court should not create an incentive for a do-over for custodians. The do-over is not in the public records law. If you say to a custodian, hey, if you get it wrong with some controversial records the first time, but after they sue, you turn the records over pretty quickly, don't worry about it, you won't pay attorney's fees. That's not in the statutes. There's no do-over in the statutes. We want the incentive to be that the custodian on the front end takes the records request seriously, and despite the fact that the records may be controversial and that the custodian may prefer to not turn them over, he or she should look at them closely, should get their attorneys involved, which happens enough on the front end.
I want to let you finish, but in my scenario, that's not what occurred. In my scenario, it was just a quick lawsuit that came sooner.
Right. And my main point so far, Justice Hagedorn, is that by permitting there no fee shifting under those circumstances, you're creating this incentive for a custodian to say, well, I'll say no to begin with, and then we'll see what happens. But substantively, I think what should happen under those circumstances is if a lawsuit has been filed, because the records are turned over, in a situation like this, the court can then determine, was the custodian justified in denying the request? And if the answer is no, then the party has prevailed in whole or substantial part. If the answer is yes, then you can look at whether the lawsuit was the reason for the
But that's different than what you just said. What you just said before is that if a lawsuit's filed and documents are then turned over, you are, by definition, the prevailing party. Now I hear you saying, no, there is a question of whether there was some admission of wrongdoing.
Justice Hagedorn, look, from my client's perspective, the news media, our strong preference, and I think there's a strong argument for it, is if you're denied, you have to sue, and then you get the records, you've prevailed. I do believe that. My point today, and what I was responding to, is there is a middle ground, and this case presents that middle ground, because in this case, the Court of Appeals has determined that the custodian was wrong. They should have turned the records over.
Court of Appeals can't make findings of fact, and if you think that's what the Court of Appeals found, I'm very troubled. I think the Circuit Court heard arguments. The Circuit Court did make some findings of fact about this case, but I don't think the Court of Appeals did.
It found maybe the wrong word, Justice Rogenczyk, held.
I think so.
I think the Court of Appeals held that the custodian was wrong. The custodian should not have denied the records request at the time of the denial. And as I think we've heard today, the justification just wasn't there under the balancing test under 19.851E, there weren't competitive or bargaining reasons at the time of the denial. And my point is, when the custodian gets it wrong, denies a request they should have granted, there's no other avenue of recourse for the requester but a mandamus action. And under those circumstances, it seems to me you prevailed. You were denied. You did what you had to do, file a mandamus action. The records were turned over. You have prevailed.
What if the custodian, though, ultimately got it right but turned over the records for reasons unrelated to the merits of the case? I can assure you, as someone who oversaw public records operation for the Office of the Governor for 5 years, that happens sometimes. How would you respond to that? I understood your position to be inconsistent with that.
It is. If you deny a records request...
Not deny, just not do it, maybe as quick as custodians might want you to.
Well, there's quite a bit of flexibility under the statute, which I'm not thrilled with, but as soon as practicable and without delay, I think there tends to be communication, and the 10 days is not an absolute rule. In fact, the Attorney General and its guidance suggests that the 10 days is kind of, you know, a minimum, but certain circumstances, whether there's redactions, whether there's legal counsel involvement, it may take longer than that. So I believe the law provides the flexibility necessary for a custodian to do the right thing on the front end, to get involved, the people that need to be involved, make the right decision. I see that my red light is on. May I finish my point?
You may.
Thank you. And to come to the right decision, and if the custodian does not do so, if the custodian wrongly denies the request, then it forces the requester to file a mandamus action, and then the records are turned over for whatever reason it seems to us that the requester has prevailed under the statutes.
Thank you
very much.
All right, Mr. Bruce.
Thank you. There's been a great deal of statements to the effect that the Court of Appeals decided that that Friends was a prevailing party, and that is the basis for its decision. I just think it's important to note that I'm really not sure that's what the Court of Appeals was saying in its holding. If you look at paragraph 4 of the decision, the holding is, quote, "We hold that where litigation is pending and an authority releases a public record because a public records exception is no longer applicable, causation is not the appropriate inquiry for determining whether the requesting party substantially prevailed. Rather, the key consideration is whether the authority properly invoked the exception in its initial decision to withhold release." Now, to me, that statement makes no sense, especially in light of the Court of Appeals statement that the exception in this case was never evoked. They seem to be addressing a situation where an exemption was properly evoked and the documents later released when it was no longer applicable. I'm really not sure what the Court of Appeals is doing in this case, frankly, but I do know that they are trying to alter the test, and I think that's something that cannot be done. Otherwise,
Counsel, thank you. Your opposing counsel indicates a middle ground of what the Court of Appeals arrived at. And I look at the text of the statute, and I see that the text of the statute, and I'm referring to 19.37 sub 2, doesn't require prevailing to be a prevailing party, but rather substantially or in substantial part. So what's the difference between prevailing in whole vis-a-vis prevailing in substantial part? And is prevailing in substantial part a middle ground? But what's the difference, and middle ground are the two double barrels of this question?
I don't think that's ever been addressed by the Court of Appeals. Anything I could say would really simply be speculation. I don't see how a party could prevail under a mandamus action without there being some determination to the effect that records must be turned over. So I would disagree with counsel for friends in the amicus in construing prevailing, substantially or otherwise, in any other sense.
So counsel, in your reading then, a party could assert a reason, even if it was not a good reason, and even if it was not a reason that fell under the statute, but they could just assert one. And as long as they turn over the records before a court finds that they have to, as long as they voluntarily do it, they don't have to pay attorney's fees.
Unless the litigation was a cause of the turnover.
Well, isn't that what we're deciding here? But under, I mean, do you agree with what I said? So in this case, let's just say your client did not have a valid reason, a valid exception, that they just made it up. Like, let's say there was no other parties, there was no other negotiation, there was none of that. They asserted it because they wanted to, or maybe they even thought it could be a reason, but it didn't turn out to be. No attorney's fees. Even though the other party had instituted a lawsuit in an attempt to get the records. As long as they're voluntarily turned over before a court reaches a decision, no attorney's fees.
I think the law as it stands currently, which is different from what the Court of Appeals rules, does require that there be an element of causation involved for purposes of obtaining the attorney's fees.
Counsel, just want to follow up. I thought you said that the Court of Appeals didn't hold that you wrongfully withheld the records. But, I mean, in the paragraph after in the holding, it said, we hold that the city's reliance on the competitive or bargaining reasons exception was unwarranted and led to an unreasonable delay in the records release. So it strikes me as a pretty clear statement. Now, obviously, the question is, you know, do we agree with that proposition of law? But it strikes me that if we did agree with that, that you would have wrongfully withheld the records, right?
If they did agree that the exemption was properly evoked, sure if I understood.
Sorry, maybe I misheard you earlier, but the Court of Appeals, indicated that you wrongfully withheld records.
Yes.
Right. And then a lawsuit comes, then you maybe voluntarily release them, but for some period of time, you unlawfully withheld the records, as the Court of Appeals reasoned it, right?
Yes. Yes, no, I didn't mean, perhaps what I'm doing more than anything else is expressing my confusion regarding the Court of Appeals holding here. Because I do seem to think, I do think they actually say, and they quoted that causation is not an appropriate inquiry where an exemption was properly evoked and that records were released when it was no longer applicable, which I just find hard to understand.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
All right, we've concluded the arguments for today. Thank you for presenting your good briefing and arguments, and we will take this matter under consideration. The court is adjourned. Thank you.